Welcome back to the second half of the Making Waves program. We're going to start with some announcements. On Saturday, April 2nd at 8 p.m., Dave Lippman and or the world's only known singing CIA agent, George Shrub, will be performing live and in concert. He is a singer, songwriter, political satirist, and he'll be performing at the Coffee House at 6 Lock Street in Andover, Mass. The phone number is 978-475-4452 for more information. The doors will open at 7:30 p.m. and there will be refreshments. This event is sponsored by the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Andover and co-sponsored by the Merrimack Valley People for Peace. Suggested donation is $10. George Shrub has been traveling throughout his globalized domain, sharing his point of view, the right one, so that people won't need their own. He employs anti-folk songs and interventionary anthems to explain and enforce that the business of America is none of your business, that unions are never civil, and that the proper place for himself, like Walmart, is everywhere. Lippman, meanwhile, has been trying to keep up with his own shadow, Shrub, touring closely behind him. He continues to afflict the complacent, occasionally rhyming in the process. Dave has been known to take the air out of the windbags of the week, de-distort history, and rewrite the classics with parody and thrust. Mr. Lippman is the founder of the International Federation of Investigative Songwriters, which no one has joined. He remains one of America's foremost non-corporate comedians. Next, on Tuesday, April 5th at 6 p.m., there will be an event called Native American Voices, U.S. Imperialism from a Native American Perspective, and Traditional Flute Performance. This is happening at the UU South Church in Portsmouth at 292 State Street, Portsmouth, New Hampshire. The flute concert will begin at 6 p.m. with David Sanipass of the Mi'kmaq Nation. At 7 p.m., there will be a talk called U.S. Imperialism from a Native American Perspective with Chris and Liz Charlebois. Chris Charlebois is a Native artist and activist. Liz Charlebois is an Abenaki basket maker. Together, they will offer insight and perspective on the U.S. wars of aggression, resource theft, and Western racism, past and present. David Sanipass is a traditional flute player and the storyteller for the Mi'kmaq Nation. The stories David tells have been passed down for generations. His flutes are made in the tradition of his grandfathers. David began to learn from his grandfather at 9 years old to make and play flutes. He harvests and carves the wood, mostly lightning-struck white cedar, the crystallized wood giving the finished flute a unique sound and tone. The light fragrance of his sweet grass flute smooths player and listener with each note. Please join us in music and spirit to share in these truths and help us to vision a better future for us all. This event is free and open to the public. Childcare and refreshments are provided. Please contact Cal Ewing, CIL_EWING at yahoo.com for more information. That event is sponsored by Seacoast Peace Response and Seacoast Alliance for Democracy. On Tuesday, April 5th at 7 p.m., there will be a lecture at the Portsmouth Public Library as part of their spring lecture series. It's called An Introduction to the Russo-Japanese Peace Treaty. This features Commodore Michael Gilmore from the U.S. Naval Shipyard and Peter Bowman, co-chair of the Portsmouth Peace Treaty Anniversary Committee and a retired shipyard commander. An historical overview will be provided of the Russo-Japanese War, including why the two countries were at war, why Portsmouth was picked as a site for peace negotiations, and why this treaty was so important to the world. This is a lecture slide program. This event is happening in the Portsmouth Public Library in the Vaughan Room on 8 Islington Street in Portsmouth. Phone number 427-1540. On Wednesday, April 6th at 7 p.m., there will be the fifth of a 14-part multimedia series called Creating a Peaceful World, The Challenge of Oil. This includes speakers, videos, readings, and discussions on the demise of oil supplies, government policy, and solutions for sustaining our communities on Earth. This event is happening at the Dover Friends Meeting House on 141 Central Ave in Dover, New Hampshire, sponsored by the Dover Friends Meeting, Peace and Social Concerns Committee, Seacoast Peace Response, and Alliance for Democracy. This particular topic will be Weapons of Mass Deception, a video exposing the popular media. For more information, contact Phyllis Abel at 603-431-8644. On Wednesday, April 6th at 8 p.m., the Nottingham Planning Board will have a hearing involving Save Our Groundwater. The Planning Board hearing is particularly pertaining to the USA Springs Incorporated site plan application. This event will be held at the Nottingham Town Offices on Route 152. Please call 679-5022 to confirm, as the hearings have sometimes been postponed, rather inconveniently. On Thursday, April 7th, from 7 to 9 p.m., there will be the next Save Our Groundwater meeting. Save Our Groundwater will hold its next monthly meeting at the Sugar Shack on Route 4, a half mile west of the Lee Traffic Circle. This meeting will include nominations for the Save Our Groundwater Board of Directors. Bring a neighbor and help protect your water supply. For more information, contact Olivia Zink, O-Z-I-N-K, at yahoo.com. On Friday, April 8th at 6:15 p.m., there will be a planning meeting of SECO's Peace Response. Usually it happens on the first Friday of most months, but this month it's been postponed because of the Peace Parade in Portland on April 1st. This event is happening at Dr. Graff's office, 152 Court Street in Portsmouth. For more information, contact 750-7506. Also on Friday, April 8th and Saturday, April 9th, the American Friends Service Committee is having a Peace and Justice Conference. This is a major New England-wide Peace and Justice Conference to challenge the Bush administration's priorities. It's occurring at MIT in Cambridge, Mass. It's called Hope and Hard Work, Organizing to Meet the Crises Head-On. Join us to analyze, strategize, and organize to help build the multi-issue and integrated social and political movement we need to resist and overcome the Bush administration's real agenda at home and abroad. If you would like to volunteer or to request additional information, please contact Joseph Gerson at 617-661-6130. On Friday, April 8th through Sunday, April 10th, there will be an event called Music for Peace Project 2005, occurring in New York and worldwide. For further information, keep checking the website http://www.m4p.org. And finally, on Saturday, April 9th, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., there will be a Teaching Peace Conference. Teaching Peace is a conference for New Hampshire educators and community activists to address the challenge teachers face in educating the hearts and minds of young people in the 21st century and in a time of war. The conference will take place at Oyster River High School, Durham, New Hampshire. Dr. Mark Harold, Economics and Women's Studies Professor at UNH, will offer the keynote address, entitled War as an Edsel: The Marketing and Consumption of Modern American Wars. This will be followed by workshops organized in five teaching peace strands: Creating a Culture of Peace, Effects of Modern War, Why Teach Peace, Environmental Peace, Curriculum for Teaching Peace, and Personal Peace. Presenters include Tom Jackson and Joshua Meyerowitz. The conference concludes with a panel discussion comprised of grassroots peace activists such as Peaceful Tomorrows, Just Vision, SECO's Peace Response, and others. Panelists will include Amy Antonucci. For more information, contact conference planners Kay Morgan, Morgan, K-A-T-H-E-R-I-N, at comcast.net, or Melinda Salazar, M-S-A-L-A-Z-A-R, at cisunix.unh.edu. And that's all for this week's announcements. Next, we have an interview of Jan Schaefer by Amy Antonucci.
This is Amy Antonucci for Making Waves. Continuing with our March focus on women's lives and issues, I am talking today with Jan Schaefer, a national representative for the AFL-CIO, about women's work and labor issues. Jan has also worked as an organizer for the United Auto Workers, as a political organizer for the New Hampshire AFL-CIO, and is currently a member of the Communication Workers of America. Jan lives in Warner, New Hampshire. Welcome, Jan.
Hi.
Good to have you.
Thank you.
Could you start off by telling us something about the work that you do at the AFL-CIO?
Sure. The AFL-CIO is the federation of all of the different unions in the country. The majority of unions belong to it. And so I work with many different unions on organizing, on politics, and then on figuring out ways to make the labor movement more effective.
Can you speak to us about current issues around women in the workforce?
Well, I think that issues around women have stayed fairly consistent. Women are a large part of the workforce. They still earn significantly less than men, and they have many issues around trying to balance work and family. So I don't think those issues have changed all that much. I'm not sure that things have gotten that much better for women either. I think it's still very difficult for many women, but I think for many of us, not just women, but for many people who work, to try and balance the increasing demands of work against responsibilities at home. those kinds of issues are really prevalent.
You mentioned equal pay, and I know that is a long discussed and researched issue. Can you tell us what exactly that means?
There are national numbers and then there's state numbers. I think the number in New Hampshire is that for every dollar that a man earns, a woman earns 69 cents. So there's a number of reasons for that. One is just flat-out discrimination. But there are more subtle reasons, one being that women tend to work in different jobs than men work in, and some of the more traditional women's work tends to be somewhat undervalued. Another piece of it is that what's going on nationally around wages, which is that wages are falling, and so men's wages, as they relate to women's wages, have fallen. So where it might have been before, the wage gap was a little larger. Now it's a little smaller, not because women aren't necessarily doing any better. It's just that everybody's doing worse.
What has been done around that issue? What strategies for changing that are there?
Well, I mean, our strategy is that more women should organize. When you look at the results of women joining unions, the pay difference between women in unions and women not in unions, it's right around 30%. So women gain significantly when they're in a union. They also are more likely to have employer-paid health insurance and much more likely, about 35% more likely to have a pension. So we work with, we work with all sorts of workers, but, for example, I just worked with a fairly large group, about 1,200 nurses in Vermont, and that was predominantly women helping them organize a union. And some of that was around wages, but most of it was around conditions at work besides wages. It's like mandatory overtime, which if you start to look at that and you talk about how much people are working these days, it becomes a really key issue for a lot of people to talk about mandatory overtime. Not only, you know, are people struggling to balance work and family, but then if on top of that they get asked or told that they have to work overtime, it really makes that crunch that much worse.
How many people do unions represent these days?
There's about, we have about slightly over 14 million members. 6.8 of those are women. So it's about 12% of women workers are in unions.
That's pretty small.
Yep.
Has that gone down or gone up?
The rate of unionization in the country has gone down. In the 50s and 60s, it was right around 35%. So it's really declined significantly. Part of the reason for that is the way that trade and other factors have affected the economy. With a lot of manufacturing jobs going overseas, those are jobs that tended to be union jobs, and they're disappearing at a pretty rapid pace. So some of it's the changing nature of the economy. Some of it is there was a period where there wasn't a lot of union organizing going on. I think another huge factor is that there is a lot of employer resistance to workers organizing unions. That's historical as well as current, but definitely there is a very intense effort on many employers to prevent workers from joining a union.
It also seems to me that legislation and steps taken by the federal government have been very anti-union.
Well, the current administration is not by any stretch of the imagination pro-union. I mean, if you look just locally, so if you look in the seacoast of New Hampshire, right now the workers at Portsmouth Shipyard are not only faced with the possibility of base closure, but they're also looking at changes in the personnel rules in the Department of Defense by the Bush administration that are going to wipe out their collective bargaining rights.
Hmm.
So that's something that I think people in the Seacoast haven't heard a lot about. Certainly the closing of the shipyard is a huge issue over there. But for the people that work there, even as they continue to work at the shipyard, the conditions under which they work are changing. And part of that is due to the Bush administration. And they've done that throughout federal government. I mean, when they developed the Department of Homeland Security, those workers were consolidated from different departments into Homeland Security and lost their collective bargaining rights. I mean, the question, at least for me, is how does having a union impact Homeland Security. That's really not, should not be an issue. People should have the right to have a union and be able to speak up at work.
So it's been approached somewhat as an issue of Homeland Security and that mm-hmm. unions are bad for Homeland Security?
Yeah.
Wow.
So as the government was reorganized, the rules were changed under which workers are allowed to bargain.
And they cited the security of the nation in that.
They said that the union rules were getting in the way of an efficient Department of Homeland Security.
Wow.
So, you know, I think that the idea that people have a voice at work is really important in terms of maintaining the democracy that we have. You know, when you look at countries where you want to develop a democracy, you need the NGOs or the non-government organizations that help people participate in civic life. Well, unions are a really key part of that. They are really important in terms of strengthening a country's democracy. And it's of great concern that unions are beginning to disappear in this country. And it's wrong. That's not the direction our country should go.
Why is it that people don't join unions more often?
There is an entire industry based around preventing unionization. For example, the hospital I was telling you about before, that hospital hired a business that specialized in keeping the hospital union-free. And they paid that firm millions of dollars to run mandatory meetings, where nurses had to go to the meetings to have training supervisors to talk to them one-on-one and basically try and intimidate them and scare them so that they would not join the union. That is something that goes on all the time, and the National AFL-CIO is working with our allies in the House and the Senate to try and change the way workers organize. So we have a new piece of legislation called the Employee Free Choice Act, which would make it much fairer in terms of how union elections are run, and we think really help workers be able to much more easily gain a voice at work.
In your organizing and your work, have you been at all familiar with the unionization of Walmart?
Well, I mean, Walmart is notoriously anti-union. There was a small group of workers in Texas, I believe, that organized with Walmart, the meat cutters in one of their superstores. And Walmart basically said, well, we're not going to do meat cutting anymore. We're all going to do all prepackaged meat. You guys are done. And so they were able to stop that right there. But they have a very aggressive policy against unions and make it very clear to the people that work at Walmart. But in terms of women and Walmart, I think, you know, one of the more interesting things about Walmart, which is now the largest employer in the country, there's also the largest class action lawsuit in U.S. history right now going on against Walmart on behalf of the 1.6 million women who have worked at Walmart. And it's around issues of promotion, pay differentials. There's all sorts of different issues that people are raising around discrimination at Walmart. So there just are many, many employment issues at Walmart that really need addressing. I think in 30 states, there's issues around Walmart having people work off the clock or work through their breaks. Walmart, you know, has a lot of work to do around the people that work there. You know, it's a place that really sets the standards, whether that standard is good or not, because it's so large, which is why it's important what Walmart does. It's important that Walmart change how it operates in terms of how it treats its workforce.
Everyone can probably drive not very far and see a Walmart in their town or nearby. Very close to home issue.
Yeah. Americans really, we often want things really cheap. In the case of Walmart, people really need to look at how things got so cheap at Walmart. There's a number of ways. One is how they treat their workers. The other is how their merchandise is produced. People really need to start thinking about that. Everybody loves a good buy, but it's more than just the price that you pay when you go into a store, what you're buying.
Good point. I want to turn to another issue. I wondered if you could talk to us about the Social Security proposals and the particular relevance they have to women. I know that women are disproportionately dependent on Social Security.
Well, women depend on Social Security for about 71% of their retirement earnings. So it's a very key piece of retirement for working women, or for all women. And the way the system of Social Security works, it is weighted towards keeping lower income workers out of poverty when they retire. So if you have women who have worked in lower wage jobs, when they retire, Social Security is really the key to their retirement, and it is key to keeping them out of poverty in retirement. So if there's plans to either reduce benefits or privatize the system and make it riskier, that is not a good proposition for women. I mean, I don't think it's a good proposition for anyone. The way that retirement is supposed to look is you're supposed to have three pieces to have a secure retirement: Social Security, a pension plan, and savings. And most Americans at this point, they really depend on Social Security more so than those other two pieces. A lot of people find it very difficult to put money aside for retirement or for anything else. And many, many people do not have pensions where they work. So there's more and more pressure on the Social Security system to be the only security that's left in retirement for a lot of people.
Also, with the loss of union jobs, that seems to play into some of the loss of pensions.
Yeah, particularly in the political season, there's a lot of talk about how the middle class and how important the middle class is to our society. But in fact, in many ways, what helped create the middle class was a strong labor movement, so that, you know, people got a job, they got regular raises, there was a general sharing of the wealth in the country because people had the ability to sit down with their employer and come up with a contract that basically laid out what was going to be fair where they worked. So they were able to secure fairly good wages, generally health insurance, and some sort of a pension plan. As that falls away, it really leaves workers unprotected.
Going back to Social Security, the reason for it coming up, we're being told, is that it's in a crisis. It's approaching destruction, and we must stop this in order to protect workers. It seems, though, that there's a lot more to the story. What is your view on that?
There definitely is a desire on the part of the Bush administration to create a crisis. There is not a crisis. Social Security is not bankrupt. For those of us who are baby boomers, and some of us are retiring and some of us are quite a ways from retirement, but there's what I think a lot of people see as a bulge in retirement that somehow has to be met. Well, that group of people has been paying their Social Security taxes, and it's a pay-as-you-go system. So we've been paying taxes, and it's been providing Social Security to people who are already retired. But because there are so many more baby boomers than there are an older generation, we've built up a surplus in the Social Security Trust Fund. And the idea is that that money is there for this generation to use when they retire to pay the Social Security. So I think what we have is a real budget problem, because that money has been borrowed, and now the trust fund holds treasury bonds, which, when the baby boom begins to retire, will need to be drawn on. So there's a debt owed to Social Security, which I'm sure some people would like to ignore, but really can't. So I don't think that there's a crisis, but I do think that we need to pay attention to Social Security. We cannot afford to not pay back the trust fund. We could easily pay back the trust fund by not making the tax cuts permanent. That's one way that could be paid back. The fact of the matter is that what the president is proposing in terms of people diverting money out of Social Security into private accounts does nothing to help the system. It only weakens the system. It does nothing to strengthen the system. And it really puts people's retirement very much at risk, which is really not a good way for that program to go. It's been a very successful program. It has kept millions and millions of people out of poverty and provided security in people's retirement. And there's no reason to put that at risk.
I wonder what the reason is. There is something that isn't put up front.
Well, I do think that the administration does fundamentally not believe in the idea that we should all take responsibility for each other in our old age. I think the whole message around this will be a new ownership society is an effort to pull people away from the idea that we're dependent on each other. And it plants the idea in people's minds that they can do better on their own. Now, I think one thing that's really important to understand about the Bush plan is that people are going to be required to purchase an annuity in order to pay a monthly benefit from their private account. And that annuity is not something that you can pass on. It's an insurance policy that you purchase. You don't leave anything to anyone. So the idea somehow that these private accounts are yours and you can spend them as you wish and you can pass them on to your heirs is really just sort of pie in the sky.
And that would seem actually to have particular relevance for women who often have not worked as much as their spouse. If their spouse dies, they continue to get the payments?
Yes, they do. There's a couple of different pieces of Social Security. One is what we all recognize as what our parents get or friends get when they reach retirement age, which is a monthly benefit. But there are also other provisions in Social Security. There's Social Security for people who become disabled, and then there is Social Security for survivors. So if one spouse dies early, say someone is, you know, in their 30s or 40s, so they're at a high, their high end of their earning capacity, and they die unexpectedly, the Social Security system provides for what's called a survivor's benefit, which goes to that person's family. It helps with the kids. The surviving kids also get a benefit. It helps those kids go through college. So it's a very powerful program in terms of all the different benefits it provides. And I think the other thing for women, I mean, it's good for women, they live longer. So their retirement years can really be easily 20 years, 25 years. So a guaranteed benefit is really, really important to women to know that when they retire at 65, if they live to be 90, they are still going to get a benefit.
Well, Jan, thanks so much
Sure.
for joining us today. It was great to have you and great to hear your insights and information.
Well, thank you, Amy.
You're welcome.
Nice to talk to you.
We have plowed and we have planted. We have gathered into barns. Done the same work as the men, with babies in our arms. But you won't find our stories in most history books you read. We were there, we're still here, fighting for the things we need. We were there in the factories, we were there in the mills, we were there. Shops in New York, from the fields in California, where our children had to work. We fought to make a living. Bread and roses was our cry. Though they jailed and beat our bodies, our spirit never died. We were there. We were there. Latina, Chinese and Russian too. They try to use our differences to split us all apart, but the pain we felt together touched the bottom of our heart. We were there in the factories, we were there.
That was We Were There by the Brooklyn Women's Chorus. We now go to a report by Stanley Longstaff on last week's hearing in Portsmouth on the resolution in support of the Bill of Rights.
As the old expression goes, who guards the guards?
My name is Macy Morse. I think that the Patriot Act is probably pretty confusing to most of us. I don't know if anybody here has read it or wants to. But we're not here tonight really in defense of or against the Patriot Act, but rather to reaffirm the Bill of Rights and make sure that other laws that are being passed by our Congress or by fiat or mandate, by executive order, don't infringe on that Bill of Rights.
3 minutes is not going to be near enough to talk about why I oppose this resolution. So I urge the City Council, if you're thinking about passing this resolution, I urge you to hold a public hearing so that we can get up here and we can say what we want to say. Do not be duped.
On Monday, March 28th, the Portsmouth City Council held a work session to address a resolution that had been presented to the Council in February in support of the Bill of Rights. Mayor Sorrell opened the work session and then turned it over to City Attorney Bob Sullivan, who clarified that this was a work session and no action would be taken on any issues. He then introduced Tom Calantuno, U.S. attorney appointed by George W. Bush in December 2001. The council had requested that he attend the meeting and allowed him 30 minutes to speak to the resolution, and after the U.S. attorney, citizens of Portsmouth and the surrounding area would be allowed 3 minutes each to make comments.
The Patriot Act itself was passed in October of 2001, shortly about 6 weeks roughly after the attacks of 9/11. Personally, as a federal prosecutor, I believe that just about everything in the act is beneficial and shouldn't be controversial, but that's what's subject for debate here. I'd like to read you a portion of a speech given recently by our new Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez. The Patriot Act has addressed critical vulnerabilities in America's pre-September 11th defenses. First, it lowered the artificial and unwise bureaucratic wall that had prevented law enforcement and the intelligence community from sharing information about terrorist movements and plots. Second, it modernized and gave investigators legal tools for fighting in the 21st century. These are tools such as multi-point wiretaps, which have proven themselves time and again in the fight against drug smugglers, mobsters, and other criminals. These and other common sense measures included in the Patriot Act have helped our federal, state, and county officials make America safer.
Much of the defense of the Patriot Act is the fallacy of post hoc propter hoc. The sky hasn't fallen, give it the credit for it.
Unfortunately, a small but vocal minority has attempted to mischaracterize the Patriot Act. The critics have dealt in conjecture and hypotheticals. We can point to solid results, saved lives, and a nation that is safer. For more than 3 years, there has not been one verified civil rights abuse under the Patriot Act. I want to encourage you to come forward if you or your constituents have ever experienced an abuse under the Patriot Act. If there are violations, I want to know about them. Now, some critics have claimed that the Patriot Act endangers our civil liberties. Let me be clear that I think we should be free, and we are free, to question the exercise of government power when we believe it may infringe on our privacy or our civil liberties. Such debate is good and healthy for our democracy, but debate should be based on facts. And I'd like to talk just a few minutes about some of the controversial sections that seem to come up over and over again. The one that has seemed to generate the most concern, especially among the Library Association and the booksellers, was Section 215, which gave the government the authority, the FBI authority, to go in and seize business records with a court order from any business. Now, it might surprise people to know that the word library doesn't appear in the Patriot Act anywhere, but that lobby has talked so vociferously about this that everyone thinks the Act targets libraries. And some opponents have tried to make it seem like every American's reading habits are in danger of being turned over to the FBI for without good cause at all. And that's just not the case.
Right now, in a library not in Portsmouth, they are required to report certain books that are taken out. And I have a friend who is a history buff, and he was warned that they had to report certain books that he took out of the library.
The Act was cobbled together with just about every neocon rabble Justice Department wish list you could have wanted. The problem with those warrants is not that they're delayed, but that if you go to the library and get the records, they're not allowed to tell anybody. That it has to be done not quietly, swiftly, tactily, but secretly, and that you really can't question much of it.
Attorney General Ashcroft finally admitted, after 2 years of lying about it, that's pejorative on my part, of perhaps being misinformed about the nature of the Patriot Act. He finally admitted under oath, after saying for a year and a half that the law only applied to foreign citizens, that the clear words in the Patriot Act used hundreds of times, U.S. person, applied to all of us. And he also admitted, when he was put under oath in June of 2003 before a congressional committee, that in the first year alone, after passage of the USA Patriot Act, 178 public libraries were visited by the FBI to obtain information on the reading habits. And it is important to realize that any individual who has asked for information under 215, if in fact they tell you they've been asked, whether it's your doctor, your librarian, or your banker, that individual faces felony prosecution because revealing that information is a felony under the USA Patriot Act.
All the Patriot Act did was take that common sense traditional tool and apply it in the case of foreign intelligence investigations under what's called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which was passed by Congress in 1978 to deal with spying cases, going against people who are agents of foreign governments or working for foreign powers or for terrorist organizations. When that law was passed, it back in 78, it gave the a specialized court made up of federal judges to whom you apply for approvals to investigate these terrorist organizations or spy rings. Section 215 of the Patriot Act said that in the situation where the FBI has reason to believe that business records or records of any entity might contain evidence of a crime that they're investigating, they can go to a foreign intelligence surveillance court judge, that's a federal judge, show reasonable grounds to believe that this evidence might exist, and get a court order.
The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act was passed to deal with terrorism. And because of that confluence of issues, the Congress allowed diminished constitutional protections under FISA. Parts of the USA Patriot Act amend FISA. It was never intended to deal with ordinary American citizens. It was intended to deal with those who were agents of a foreign power engaged in activities to do us harm. Yet this bill amended it and applied it to ordinary U.S. citizens, to all of us in this room, to all of us in this country. From 1979, when it was passed, until 2001, an average of about 600 FISA warrants were requested. Only five of them were rejected. In 2002, there were 1,228 requests for FISA warrants, and they were all granted. And in 2003, there were 1,727 requests, almost three times the number that there had been for the first 23 years of the existence of FISA. 2003 was the first year that FISA warrants exceeded ordinary warrants in all of the courts combined in this country.
Another controversial section is Section 213, which deals with delayed notice search warrants. All the Patriot Act did was to try to make a uniform national rule and then also confirm that this is a legal, as far as Congress is concerned, this is a legal tool for law enforcement to have.
I'm here to tell you a story of a family of Portsmouth residents who would beg to differ with that. They are a Muslim family. They're residents here in Portsmouth. They are from another country, but they've lived here in the U.S. for many, many years. 2 years ago, or a little more than 2 years ago, they went off on vacation. When they returned and came back to their house in Portsmouth, the house had been entered by investigators. They left a note. Their computer was gone. Several other items were gone. Even one of their children's iPods or Game Boys, little electronic computer device, was gone. They have never been charged with a crime. They still have not received their belongings back.
And now they can simply go to a judge, and if they provide reasonable grounds, they can get a court order. This is what the agent must do. Shall specify that the records concerned are sought for an authorized investigation conducted in accordance with subsection A2. Upon application made in this section, the judge shall enter an ex parte order as requested. There is no probable cause. There is no showing of evidence. There is not even any individualized suspicion. The FBI agent or other federal agent simply says they need the records, and the judge shall enter an ex parte order. The judge has no ability to deny.
The other parts of the statute, and they had to do with sections 203 and 218, very important sections which had to do with tearing down the wall that had been built up between the investigative arms of the FBI and the counterintelligence and the counterespionage arms. That was the reason why the dots weren't connected before 9/11. One other I'll mention is Section 802, which established a new definition for domestic terrorism. It didn't create the crime of domestic terrorism. It just amended the previous statute.
From Section 802, the term duress domestic terrorism means activities that involve acts dangerous to human life and violate the criminal laws of the United States or any state, that appear to be intended to intimidate or coerce a civilian population or to influence the government of the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion, and occur primarily within the territorial jurisdiction of the United States.
One of the things that opponents like to say is that it endangers freedom of speech because you can be charged with a crime for just simply expressing your views. Well, that's not true at all. Under this definition, the activity has to already be a crime under existing state or federal law. So there's no free speech rights to be committing crimes.
You see this shirt? It says, "Turn your back on Bush." I had this shirt on at the Bush event on Social Security. I never opened my mouth. I allowed everybody else to express their right to clap and to show their First Amendment rights, even though I didn't like it. I sat there quietly and politely because that's what we're supposed to do. But afterwards, when everybody else was allowed to mingle and talk and I had gotten out of the range of the cameras, One of your Portsmouth policemen came up. I had already turned my back, so they can't even say that I was looking at anybody. And lo and behold, I am grabbed and hauled out. And I said, "Who are you?" And he said, "Never mind who I am." And I said, "You're frightening me. Who are you?" And he wouldn't tell me. And I said, "Who are you?" And then a very prominent national figure who was there with the president approached, and I said, "I'm being thrown out of here for no reason." And our representative looked at me and said, "Well, I'm leaving also," and turned his eyes to the wall so he wouldn't see what happened to me next. So this man who had an earpiece, no uniform on, started to drag me away. And he took me down to the side, opened up the door, and all I could see were police cars and dogs. I didn't know what was happening to me. And if you don't think that's frightening, be in that position sometime. And if the good attorney doesn't think that there's any problems, try wearing this shirt, sir, and see what happens.
So with all that as a background, I just wanted to touch a little bit upon the resolution that's been placed before you. The resolution itself just creates some problems that I'd like to talk about, because the gist of it is a direction to your local law enforcement officers. And I have to say, we work tremendously closely with the Portsmouth Police Department. I have the highest regard for Chief Magan and his personnel. There's a lot we do with them that I can talk about in a minute. But frankly, it might be problematic to continue to work with them having this kind of a resolution hanging over us. We fund the Portsmouth Police Department over $100,000 a year to help in anti-drug efforts called Operation Street Sweeper. We also do a lot of drug forfeiture work with them, where money comes back into the city. We also spent over half of a grant we got, an anti-terrorism grant we got from Washington, to pay for the security assessment of Portsmouth Harbor through our Anti-Terrorism Advisory Council. So there's a lot we do down here. And the reason is, frankly, of all the cities in the state of New Hampshire, Portsmouth, I hate to say this, but it's one of the primary potential target cities if any terrorist attacks were ever to happen here.
There is nothing in this simple resolution that would impede the constitutional working together of the Portsmouth police and federal agencies. And if there is, I think that they really ought to review, and you ought to review for them, what kind of working relationship they have. And I really resented listening to the federal attorney suggest that maybe some funding might be lost to the city of Portsmouth for anti-terrorism work if indeed you took this step to pass that resolution and our ports might not be quite as secure. Above and beyond that, this is not about the USA PAT Act. At least not only about that, it's about a fabric of laws, of rules, of regulations, of directions, of smirks, of statements of foreign policy that have put a chill in this country that needs to be confronted very directly. This is not just about the USA PAT Act. It is about videotaped news that is paid for by the White House and set out to stations and presented as news to this country. It's about the Freedom of Information Act that John Ashcroft, the Attorney General, ordered agencies to ignore requests for Federal Information Acts. He did that in 2002. It's about the Homeland Security Act and all that brought with it. It's about the Information Awareness Office that was headed by John Poindexter. Remember him? This is about a foreign policy that has clearly hurt us around the world by saying things such as, if you're not with us, you're against us. What kind of freedom of thought is that? And finally, this is definitely not this resolution or any of the other 350 or so that have been passed, a resolution of the left. Because listen to these groups: American Conservative Union, Eagle Forum, Free Congress Foundation, and Citizens for Rights to Keep and Bear Arms. Those are not left-wing groups, and they are working with the ACLU in an organization called Patriots to Restore Checks and Balances. Thank you.
As I understand the rationale put forward tonight for not endorsing the resolution, is that we should be afraid to endorse it. That Portsmouth is a primary potential target city. The currency of our government is fear. They want to keep us afraid. They want to keep us from raising our voice in a legitimate debate about what should be as debate-free as motherhood, the Bill of Rights, at this point in the history of this great country. But surely that's what is implicated in this book of laws that allows our government to surveil. And I say our only defense against it is to raise our voice.
So it's very essential that we have the freedom to continue to work with your local agencies, police, fire, and emergency protection. We'd hate to see something put in place that might impact on their excellent relationship we have.
I appreciate and respect Tom Colatino for being here and testifying to you tonight. But his message essentially of don't worry, be happy with the Patriot Act and the kinds of extra authority and power which we have turned over to bureaucracy and government worries me a whole lot. And his message that we should be scared because we are close to the coast reminds me of the kind of message that we often hear that if we don't approve something, something bad is going to happen to us.
Thank you, Madam Mayor and honorable members of the council. As you probably all know, I spent a year in Germany as a guest of the Germans. I heard Goebbels speak. And one of the things when I came home was the importance of individuals and citizens before the government gets too powerful, that there is a balance between those that differ. We're all terribly afraid when we saw those airplanes flying into the towers. People want to be protected. The mass of people, they're raising their families, they're working hard, they want their government to protect them. And I think it was in good faith that the senators and the congressmen who are political people voted as they did. Was it in haste? The answer is yes. It's the same way the Reichstag voted when Hitler said it was the communists that burned down the Reichstag. Well, it wasn't. It was the Nazis that burned it down. So I think we have to have a sense of suspicion. And let me say this about the state or the federal attorney. He's a political appointee. He's in concert with what the administration says. That's why he was appointed. He agrees with them.
The quote that you heard was from Benjamin Franklin. He who would surrender essential liberty for a little temporary safety deserves neither liberty nor safety. And to that, Thomas Jefferson added, and he will lose both. Thank you.
Hey, Mr. President, you can have my civil rights. Just leave me one or two to use when I go out Friday night. Lots of evildoers out there who hate democracy, so we must give up our freedom to preserve our liberty. Well, you should question my neighbor, search his place, take him downtown. He's either Buddhist or he's Muslim, I forget, but hey, he's brown. Either way, what I'm trying to say is he ain't like me and you. And listen here, why should I fear? You know everybody loves the Jews. Well, stop me on the highway, search my car and my cavity. Delve into my past like I'm a Supreme Court nominee. If I don't got nothing to hide, then why should I complain? And if I don't like it, I can always go live with Castro or Hussein. Hey, Mr. Cheney, you can have my civil rights. Just leave me one or two to use when I go out Friday night. Lots of evildoers out there who hate democracy, so we must give up our freedom to preserve our liberty. Well, I'm a real American, bought a little flag to prove I ain't no commie, fascist, Muslim, pinko fag. I hang it on my window to show how much I care. Just don't ask me if I owned it when them big buildings still there. Well, I'm an atheist, so I won't get pissed if you take away Amendment the First, freedom of the press. Who do I look like? William Randolph Hearst. peaceable assembly, redressing grievances. Boy, that sounds like hippie talk. We don't need your words, man. Ain't you heard? All the doves have turned to hawks. Well, I love the Constitution, but we need a new addition. Not a total demolition, just a small redefinition. Let's commit not to the mission, make a couple small additions, like the use of intuition to declare the opposition. Some thumbing through the articles, I offer admonition at the dangerous omission of a law against sedition. You needn't be a politician or a nuclear technician to make a requisition for a couple new submissions. I heard Mr. Bush say there's a new kind of war out there. Apparently it's the kind you don't gotta get Congress to declare. I heard Mr. Lott say there ain't no minority. Then he stared at Mr. Gephardt, who nodded sheepishly. Hey, Mr. Ashcroft, you can have my civil rights. Just leave me one or two to use when I go out Friday night. Lots of evil doers out there who hate democracy. So we must give up our freedom to preserve our liver, 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 preserve our liberty.
That was Uncivil Rights by Adam Brodsky. Thanks for joining us for Making Waves. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Brian Gregg, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Dino Pappas, Joanne Paradise, and Jeff White. We welcome and need your participation, too. Please contact us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to volunteer or let us know what you think of the show. To hear previous shows, please visit our archive online at freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. You can also live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com/radio. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We'll be exploring themes around money and war since the following week is Tax Day. We leave you with this quote: "To announce that there must be no criticism of the president, or that we are to stand by the president right or wrong, is not only unpatriotic and servile, but is morally treasonable to the American public." Theodore Roosevelt.